www.ccfn.org. Upcoming info session dates and recordings are accessible online at www.diversecityfund.org. The phone number for further information is 202-743-0130. That's 202-743-0130.
Yo, peace, this is
Rod Stars. Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
Put the finger roll! Plus the foul!
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. This is the place where sports and politics collide. Brought to you by that home for jazz and justice, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. Of course, talking about WPFW Pacifica, needed now more than ever, and I cannot say that more with my chest. Joined this week by Chuck Modiano. So much to discuss on my docket. Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right, DZ. How about yourself?
Man, I'm doing well, because as difficult as things are, what we want to do on this show is not just talk about what's terrible, because I feel like in a lot of ways people know that. But I do want to speak about strategies for resistance and how we can make dissent visible everywhere, because that's what we got to be doing right now. That's what I think is the key, because so many people are enraged about what's happening, particularly in this area where the layoffs and the anti-immigrant attacks are affecting this community, this DC, this broader DC community, so intimately that we need to show people that there is resistance, so people lose the fear, lose the sense that they have to comply or they'll be next, and instead start to strategize about how we can effectively fight back.
That was well said, sir.
Well, thank you, sir. And one of the first things that comes to mind to me is we might as well start with the question. I mean, I have so much I want to talk to you about, but I'd actually like to start by talking about this question of the Kennedy Center. The Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., people who listen to WPFW has done programming at the Kennedy Center. People who see it as just this kind of place on national TV where the Mark Twain Awards would always, you know, be, and you have everybody in their tuxes and the like, don't really understand that institution and all it has done over the years for underserved communities, for DC public schools, for providing a place, not just for the beauty of art and music and theater and comedy and so much more, but also a place where otherwise unheard voices could have the platform that is considered so incredibly exalted in our society, thereby legitimizing, and I hate that word, but it's just a fact in our society, legitimizing voices that had otherwise been marginalized. Chuck, any experience for you with the Kennedy Center before I go on?
Yeah, I know I've been to the Kennedy Center a few times, and you would think that some of the people play, I'm going to tell you some of the people I saw at the Kennedy Center, you wouldn't believe it. I saw Nas perform at the Kennedy Center and with an entire orchestra behind
him. You went to that
him.
Show? Oh, I'm so jealous.
I went, I'm a Nas fan. You know, you talk hip-hop.
I tried.
Mike talks hip-hop. But since we're here and you asked me the question, yeah, I went there. It was wonderful. The whole orchestra behind him, he played everything. You know, it was time I came up. We love Nas, a true lyricist. And I also went, and there was an old school hip hop festival where they had everybody. Kool Moe Dee was there. Oh, everybody from like the 80s was there, going way back. That was very enjoyable. So I've been there a few times, and I also most recently, believe it or not, Maxwell was there. So I'd seen Maxwell, and I was a little upset because, you know, it closed and he didn't play work at the end. I was a little upset about that because I thought that you had to do that. You had to absolutely play that, but I'm not going to complain too much. But the point is that, you know, I mentioned maybe artists that you wouldn't think or people wouldn't think would be at the Kennedy Center.
You know what I once did at the Kennedy Center was I was on stage once.
Really?
Emceeing an edition of Voices of a People's History of the United States. Where,
with Howard Zinn.
Yeah, Howard Zinn. And I was doing the Howard Zinn role because he had just passed.
That's right.
In the Howard role of introducing each performer, doing a monologue from a People's History of the United States, a mixture of famous folk and a mixture of activists doing those readings, as in the tradition of Howard Zinn. And one of the people up there actually was, we're going back to hip hop, was Lupe Fiasco.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Back when Lupe was at his height. So the crowd there was so incredibly young, so incredibly diverse. And maybe they were there to see Lupe.
Yeah.
But man, they got to hear all sorts of other things as well, including Michael Ealy read Malcolm X. And I mean, that's the one I really remember. People might know the actor Michael Ealy.
Yeah, was he wearing glasses when he was reading Malcolm X? Was he wearing Malcolm X glasses?
No, he was not, but
he dropped the ball.
Yeah, but his cadence, and I mean, it really, you did have this feeling of Malcolm spiritually being there. It was unbelievable. Well, let me just say this. The days of Voices of a People's History and Nas with the orchestra are dead as roast chicken.
Is it because you were named the new chairman of the Kennedy Center?
Donald Trump, new chairman, and then a whole host of Fox News idiots are basically the board. And of course, J.D. Vance's wife, Usha Vance, the only person of color on the committee. And that in and of itself is just a lovely sign. Usha Vance, who met J.D. Vance at a study group at Yale that was basically a white supremacist study group.
Yeah.
And she has not gone public and said anything, as J.D. Vance has defended one of Elon Musk's Doge staffers who wrote anti-Indian rhetoric on his social media. Now, I want y'all to think about that for a second, because imagine J.D. Vance's kids knowing that their dad would defend a racist before he would defend their mom and them. All I got, it couldn't be me, man. And those kids are going to grow up and either be stone cold rebels or have serious, serious problems. And I actually pity them in all of this because their father is so disgusting. But to go back to the Kennedy Center, there's a debate that's going on right now, Chuck, of people who are already booked at the Kennedy Center.
Ah,
what do you do? That's the long way of me going back to this.
That's a good point. You know, 50% of ticket sales are down already.
Already.
So this is a good question. Do you have any sense of the lineup? Sorry if I put you on the spot and don't know the answer.
No, not at all. No, that's good, because these questions are complicated. And I'm going to bring this to sports for a second. Like, here's the real, to me, the only indefensible position, honestly, is go there, perform, at what I'm calling the Vichy Kennedy Center, the Occupied Kennedy Center, going there, performing, and not saying a thing, pretending it's business as usual. That, to me, frankly, is an indefensible position. But do you boycott, or do you go on stage and put it down as far as what's actually happening there? And this has been in my mind so much for two reasons. One, earlier this week, I spent a good deal of time, because he was in town, with the great Dr. John Carlos, 1968.
I knew you were going there. I knew you were going there, and my head was already there. But continue, sir. Continue.
Thank you. John Carlos, Tommy Smith raised their fists at the 1968 Olympics. For folks like Chuck who know the history, you know that Smith and Carlos were faced with a rather wrenching decision before the Olympics. Do we boycott? Because there was a boycott movement that had fallen apart, but still a couple of people, one of them Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, were adhering to it. Do you boycott? Or do you show up and register your resistance for the whole world to see?
Well, I think the question answers itself. And we've talked about this, and I'm glad you brought up, you know, Kareem, which is incredible to boycott at his the young age. I believe he was about UCLA and still moving, and he boycotted. But guess what? I could talk to anyone who knows anything about sports or doesn't even know about sports, and I talk about Tommy Smith and John Carlos, and they know. And they know what happened, and that created a firestorm at the time, and then over time, it's become this legendary sports activism. Nobody knows Kareem boycotted the Olympics. Right. Oh, you have to be a sports head to really know Kareem boycotted the Olympics. So in my view, that question sort of answers itself. So if an artist did come on and want to make some statement, you know they're going to be cameras at the Kennedy Center catching it, talking about that resistance. So drawing from that very clear history, I'm on the latter side. But if you go there and just perform, then you might as well stay home.
See, what's interesting, though, is John Carlos and Tommy Smith clearly made the right decision, giving us an iconic moment for the ages. But I'll say at the same time, Kareem did not make the wrong decision to not show up, because these questions are about, they're not principles. You know what I'm saying? It's about timing. It's about tactics. It's about what you think is going to be effective in the moment. There are other issues as well, as far as risk. Kareem, for example, has been very open about the fact that he could afford to boycott because he was so good. He was going to be the number one pick no matter what in the NBA. So he knew, at least from a financial perspective, it wasn't going to cost him a dime to do that. I mean, there is that question. He's very open about that. He said, because I had the privilege to risk.
Yeah, I'm glad you came back with that, DZ. You know, it's rare we were going back and forth and you come back right with something. I'm like, let me maybe adjust what I said a little bit.
You do it to me all the time, so it's all good.
Yeah, no, but I mean in real time. Normally it takes me a minute, right? But I'm like, even right as you're talking, okay, I was getting amped up. The people who come to the Kennedy Center aren't Kareem number one pick. You know what I mean? Even when I'm going back to this old school hip hop show, I went through the 80s, Roxanne, we saw that. There are a lot of us older folks there watching it. And guess what? I don't know if the lineup that we saw maybe even can afford to make a statement. I'll let that be their statement. So I do agree with you about Kareem. A boycott is fine. Okay? A boycott is fine. I'm not against a boycott. But I do believe if you're not going to boycott and you're still going to go on stage, I would like to see something. So either way is fine. But the second one is more risk. There is question. You, like Trump could shut you down and cut you down. And we know this in everything that we are doing. And every protester knows that there are risks in what you're doing. And Kennedy Center is not necessarily, you know, getting Taylor Swift is not coming to the Kennedy Center. Beyonce is not coming to the Kennedy Center. Kendrick Lamar is not coming to the Kennedy Center. It's people who usually, you know, their time in the sun has been up and they're just bringing it back one more time. They're not filling arenas. So that's a good point.
Yeah, and I raised all this because yesterday two things happened and that regarding the Kennedy Center, and I didn't disagree with either decision. And it kind of fits this template of what we're talking about, you and me right now. Because one of my absolute heroes is a banjo player, plays more than the banjo, but that's what she's most known as, Rhiannon Giddens, an absolute genius, was due to play on May 11th, and she very publicly canceled and moved her appearance to the anthem. And it was, and she also said in her thing, look, artists have to make this decision. And I had so much respect for Rhiannon Giddens, who draws a lot of her music from Black history. It is incredible. You know, she's being credited actually for not single-handedly because others have done it, but she's being credited for example, Beyonce's album that won Best Album at the Grammys, Cowboy Carter, like actually reclaiming the Black history in bluegrass and country, which was forcibly uprooted by the corporate powers of country Western music to create a white alternative to rock and roll. So Rhiannon Giddens is young still and a very, very, at this point, historic genius in terms of what she's been able to do. So her saying that I am not going to let my specific kind of music, which is about the glory of Black culture and Black history, be used as a kind of fascist fig leaf for the Kennedy Center to be like, oh, look, it's not really that bad. Look, Rhiannon Giddens.
Fascist like, fig leaf. That's why I like you. That is why I like you, DZ.
Don't stop. But her doing that. It was actually what was an important thing to say, I'm not going to the anthem. That being said, I also have so much love for a singer-songwriter named Victoria Canal, who on the, and she is somebody who is, she is a disabled, queer, Latinx woman. And she got up there at the Kennedy Center, announced beforehand that she was given all the money that she was getting to a trans civil rights organization. Ooh. And she did her performance on stage wearing a sweatshirt that said anti-Trump AF. And she presented the sweatshirt by taking off by unzipping her jacket, and the crowd like just went into just like huge applause for her. So there's a point for that, as there's a place for that as well. And I guess I'm saying this because, you know, we're a station that, you know, a lot of people listen to who love the artists out there and who have frequented the Kennedy Center. And I want people to just keep in mind that, like, people should be boycotting the Kennedy Center. Absolutely. You know, rip its legitimacy from it. And people who go there also and call out the Kennedy Center in a visible fashion in the tradition of Tommy Smith and John Carlos, that is very welcome as well. So I'm not giving like some definitive answer. I'm just saying that politics is about timing. Politics is about who you are. Like Victoria Canal could not have just said, well, I'm just going to go to the anthem instead and sold it out. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Rhiannon Giddens could. So she was able to leverage the talent of her fame, the privilege of her fame, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. There are all these calculations. You know, we love to say, you know, everybody who's famous should do this. The calculations are different. And I will say this. If someone does say, I'm going to harm my entire career, then I want to know that it's going to make a little bit of a difference, right? I think it's fair to say it's going to make it. Otherwise, they could come out with a protest in the street every day in D.C. But you almost want to know you're moving the needle. I try to find this space because I know like how I feel. Like I could sit here and just be like, everybody should do this and do that. But you kind of want to know that you're going to move the needle a little bit. And, you know, certain people move the needle. When Colin Kaepernick took a stance, that absolutely moved the needle. He gave his career for it. That was a heavy price to pay, but he moved the needle. If you're at the end of the bench, there were about 50 to 55 different individuals at that time who kneeled as well. and many were very marginal players, backup players, and they're kind of disappeared the next year, right?
Yep.
They disappeared, and it's, you know, if you're on the bubble, they could say, yeah, you weren't good enough, and they spent their whole life trying to play, and made those players, they didn't necessarily get any value. Now, I'm not, you know, where I stand, I want everybody to take that need together, and when you do that together, then you disrupt the system. And I think about when we talk about things at this stage, of this stage in protest and strikes that are going on in general, strikes that we hope to go on and boycott, we want these things to be in numbers, not necessarily as individuals. That's where, right. That's where you make the real change.
Because that's where the power is. Like we I believe talked last week about former NFL punter Chris Cluey.
That's right.
And his civil disobedience in front of the MAGA City Council in Huntington Beach, California. And to say something about Cluey and that action, he was somebody who lay down, he made the police carry him out, all the stuff. I had people get in touch with me who said, okay, I appreciate what he did, but we can't be acting as lone individuals. You know, we need organization. And I had to say back to them, well, actually, he is part of an organization.
The NFL.
No, in Huntington Beach.
Oh, okay. Oh, that was good. I thought you were going a different direction.
Yeah.
And what organization is that?
Well, it's just a Huntington Beach anti-MAGA formation that's trying to defend their library from being taken over and all this stuff. But the point is like sometimes we also make assumptions without knowing the whole story. Like,
okay.
I was just going to say, like, my friend and your friend of the show, W. Kamau Bell, he performed at the Kennedy Center, really the first performance after the MAGA takeover. And there was a protest outside of drag performers, LGBTQ people, because that was the first, those performances were the first things that the Trump mafia orbit was attacking. And people were like criticizing Kamau and for doing it. And I was like, how many people really knew that the demonstrators were doing it in conjunction, like Kamau had been in contact with them, and Kamau even spoke at their demonstration before coming in? It's like, we got to get all the facts and understand things. Otherwise, sometimes we end up just sniping at each other. And I guess that's why I really wanted to raise this Kennedy Center thing, because, you know, sometimes, Chuck, we're so disgusted with the lassitude of the Democratic Party. We're so disgusted that this Musk, Trump, incompetent brigade is running roughshod over the federal government. We're so disgusted with Jeff Bezos of the Washington Post, who we're going to talk about on the other side of the hour, that sometimes we kind of go after each other because what we think we're doing isn't up to the task. Because sometimes the only thing we feel like we can affect is going after each other because we have a sense of such helplessness at making Hakeem Jeffries wake up and not say to Stephen A. Smith, who's one of the only people Hakeem Jeffries has done a darn interview with, say, I won't bend the knee to Trump and I won't bend the knee to the radical left. And that's why the radical left hates me.
Yeah, he'll bend the knee to AIPAC.
Sure will.
You know,
Mr. AIPAC, so much money.
Right.
And Hakeem Jeffries certainly isn't alone with that, but he is the head of the Democratic Congressional formation. So people see that, feel that frustration, because they know AIPAC has more of a say over Jeffries than we do.
Wait, clarify that for me. You see, with regards to Jeffries, you see that frustration. What's that frustration?
The frustration, and it's really not just with Jeffries, it's with Chuck Schumer, it's with anybody who's in the Democratic Party leadership.
They're pathetic.
Because they're pathetic.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, what's because it's like what I get mad at, Chuck, is when people say, well, what about AOC this? Or what about, and this is somebody I respect greatly, Rashida Tlaib that? Because when you start doing that, what you do is you create this kind of fiction that if we just elected more people like AOC or Tlaib, then that's the way we're going to change the Democratic Party. Instead of looking at it institutionally and the way it institutionally is responding to this moment right now, not to mention the way it institutionally responded to the campus protests of the last year, which really discredited it among the very multiracial youth in this country who by all means should be leading a resistance, but instead really do feel like at this point, because we haven't built anything independent, they don't feel like they have a place to go.
Right. Now, I have it. I'm half with you on this and half, I don't know if I'm half not with you on this, but I do make certain distinctions. So like if you bring up, say AOC and Rashida Tlaib, like I'm someone who actually never uses the word the squad. I never, ever use it. And the reason I don't use it is that it lumps this team together, and it's predominantly Black women and women of color together, as if they all have the same exact opinion. And I understand why we want to do that, because people are saying, okay, we need to go outside the system to make change, and they're right. But Cori Bush and Rashida Stinks kind of steadfast on Palestine from day one, it doesn't mean I'm agree with any congressperson's decision, are very different than some votes that maybe AOC had put out or statements that AOC had said. So I look at them different. I actually almost separate Cori and Rashida in that way. But what I do think is important, and like to critique, is Hakeem Jeffries. You brought him up. He didn't just say bad comments. He said, "I'm going to." What did you said the exact words? But he was making the equivalent between the far right white supremacist and Trump. And according to him, the extreme left, okay? Now, when I saw that, I take personal offense that my anti-genocide view, that the protesters' anti-genocide view, is somehow making an equivalent to Trump's white supremacy. These things are not the same. And if anyone deserves to be checked for making that blasphemous, horrible analogy and being corrected and being shamed, I do believe he earned it, because Hakeem Jeffries was trying to shut down these protesters and like almost as their white supremacists, and position himself as some person in the middle who's reasonable, when in reality, you won't bend the knee to anti-genocide protesters, but you did bend the knee to AIPAC. And while you're saying you're being measured about how you approach fighting back against this fascist regime, you weren't measured in going in any of your comments for Israel when he is on the stump since 2014, saying Israel now, Israel tomorrow, Israel forever, taking the words of George Wallace of American apartheid and then defending Israeli apartheid. I think you earn a punch to the from the left and to the right by doing that. So we got to check that and make sure people don't follow of that language and a person like that, but follow the people in the streets who are doing the real fighting, because we don't want to redirect energy into a place that is not going to fight for you, which is the Democratic Party right now.
Yeah, amen to everything you said right there. I don't disagree with a darn word of it. Not a single word. And, you know, the thing is, too, it's like, how demoralized must Rashida Tlaib be right now? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like she just spent the year not being attacked by Republicans, but by her own party. And also you said, Chuck, just to put a fine point on something, you said treated like white supremacists. Jared Moskowitz, Josh Shapiro, two leading Democrats, they said explicitly that they were the moral equivalent of the people in Charlottesville who killed Heather Heyer.
Wow.
So it wasn't just about being treated like them. And I'll give you one more stat, Chuck. And this just came out in a recent study. You ready to have your mind blown?
I'm ready.
All right. Think about the 1960s Vietnam protests on college campuses. Think about the building occupations that occurred all across the country. Think about the pitched battles with police and even National Guardsmen that took place on our college campuses. Total number of arrests, 4,000. Think about the campus protests on a profoundly smaller scale this past year for Palestine. Total number of arrests, 3,200. Think about that, though.
Yeah.
Think about the proportionality. Think about it. Think about, first of all, how more fascistic our country has become since Vietnam. But not only that, think about the way people were treated for doing things. And I spoke to a lot of protesters like this during the encampments, Chuck. People who really just thought, oh, well, this is what students do when there's injustice abroad. You do what they did during apartheid. You set up an encampment. You do what they did in Vietnam. You do a building occupation. I mean, Lord knows, Chuck, how many building occupations I did when I was in college around a host of different issues. They just thought, a lot of them just thought, this is what students do.
This is free speech.
Yeah. And think about how they've been treated since then. Like the attacks, the people on double secret probation. The person who did this study, and this was a very intensive study, said the most disappointing part was I could not get information from the colleges.
Oh, yeah.
You could get the arrest information because that's public record. Yeah, but you MPD. Can't get how many people are on like double secret probation. You know what I'm saying? You can't get that. You can't get how many people are a mess up away from being expelled or were expelled. Actually, you can get the expulsions. But everybody who is now on a razor's edge of, am I going to be able to stay in this country just because I did what students have done for decades?
Yeah.
That's what's not being reported on.
No, that's not being reported on. And that kind of secrecy is also consistent with that the movement to find out information. Remember, it was disclosed. These are the chants at the campuses. Disclose, divest, we will not stop, we will not rest. Disclose, divest, we will not stop, we will not rest. So let me start on disclose. People went to the divest. They were fighting just for the information of how you are in bed with AIPAC or Israel or the weapons manufacturers, Department of Defense. They were asking for information, and in the schools, particularly the nine in DC that were in solidarity on the George Washington University campus, had a lot of trouble getting that information. So this is what they do. Not being transparent is what they do, and this is consistent with that.
Amen times 10. Well, yo, we got to go to break right now. When we come back, we got to talk about an issue that speaks absolutely to the heart of Washington, D.C., and that's the current state of the Washington Post.
That's right.
And we have to speak to another issue that's to the heart of, I know this for a fact, a lot of PFW listeners, and that's the state of things at MSNBC.
And one more thing. We want to talk about the anniversary of Aaron Bushnell 2 days ago. In front of the White House, there was vigils for that man.
But we're going to start with that then. We'll be back right after this on The Collision.
Even if he had it in me, he got to die. I killed little Jason. He was only 15. Sewed his good traits together, made Ali. Filled his lungs with the Quran until he breathed. Let him walk, but kept him on a short leash. Here he stand now, 17-year-old man child. Ain't asked nobody for a month. Hand out. He's trying to carry heaven on his back. Jumped the broom with a stranger. Ain't never looked back. What he know about how the world spins? Bless his heart. He a virgin, never even had a girlfriend. Wanna be a man so bad that he can taste it. His family fell apart and he trying to replace it. You'll find in him a heart that's second to none. But I know, oh soul, that his lessons ain't done. So I stand willing to kill him again. If to grow, he got to shed his skin and let it be done.
We are back here on The Collision, where sports and politics collide. I got to ask, Magic Mike, if you're on the mic, can you tell us what we were just listening to?
That was Brother Ali, Freedom Ain't Free.
I got to tell you, Brother Ali just did a terrific performance out in Seattle with my man Gabriel Teodros. I don't know if you're familiar with Gabriel's work, Mike. He's a Pacific Northwest legend for his hip-hop show and mixes and all the rest of it. I might have to hook you guys up. And it was great to see Brother Ali on Facebook with Gabriel. Huge smile on his face, man. It gave my heart joy. That's all I'm going to say. Taking it to you, Chuck, speak a little bit about who Aaron Bushnell was, the vigil that took place, and then we got to talk Washington Post.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, over a year ago, February 25th, Aaron Bushnell is a part of the Armed Services of America, and he took a stance, not one I recommend, but something that we really need to lift up. Self-emulation, is that the word that is used, that where he had set himself on fire, that he felt so desperate about what was happening, and that his position as a being in the U.S. military had to make a statement. And that was his statement, and he did it right in front of the Israeli embassy, which and there was a vigil to honor him in front of the embassy. And he made some statements, and he made some questions, and I'll just ask one of them right now, state one of them right now, which is, quote, "Many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery or the Jim Crow South or apartheid? What would I do? What would I do if my country was committing genocide? And the answer is, you're doing it right now." That was his message. You're doing it right now.
Wow. And also, you know, when people take the radical action that Aaron Bushnell did, it is also, we have to recognize, a cry of despair.
Yeah.
Because of the absence. I mean, if there was the kind of movement where every person was valued taking on this genocide, I think he makes a different choice.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. And so it's just like the Buddhist monks who did the same in Vietnam when nobody was paying attention to the injustices in Vietnam. It is not dissimilar at all.
It is not. And although, I'll add,
can I just say one little difference?
Yeah.
The way these things are covered, though,
like
Buddhist monks took their actions, it was seen as an act of great will and determination in the face of profound injustice. Aaron Bushnell, immediately, they go through his personal life. No one went through the Buddhist monks' personal lives. And they look for reasons that aren't rooted in the politics, so they don't have to face why he was doing what he was doing, which was also just so nefarious at the time. I remember that making my blood boil.
It was making my blood boil. Or the crowd that says, oh, he must be mentally ill. And the subtext behind that, that if you were so desperate that if you wanted to stop a genocide and you took an act against attention, it has to be illness, when in reality, we live in an ill, mentally ill, sick society where the norm is so sick that normalizes this genocide that you would bring someone to that level of desperation. What's sick is the sick society. This is a man who is just desperate, and all the regular channels of trying to fight the empire were closed off. And I want to end here.
What's mentally ill is a president, and I'm sure people saw this, who releases an AI video about taking ravaged Gaza and turning it into a place where he and Netanyahu, big bellies out, are lying on the beach at their new Riviera, which is never going to happen. And we have to understand that when he puts out videos like that, it's to make us infuriated. It's to make his base giggle at how infuriated we are. And while his base is giggling, guess what? His base is also getting the measles.
That's right.
Having their army bases that fund the whole town shut down. You know, Atan, who is from Oklahoma, our co-host Atan Thomas, put a spotlight on this area in Oklahoma where now just about everyone is unemployed. The MAGA mayor is like, hey, this is going too far. I love the Trump agenda, but this is not okay. And Kamala Harris got 32% of the vote in that particular area. So, and I'm not one of those people who's like, ha ha, you voted for it, now what you get, because I take no joy from people suffering at all. And I also think our electoral system is so screwed up that I'm not gonna throw shade on these results. But at the same time, it just speaks to the fact that I'm sure that mayor was chuckling up a storm at that AI video. And then, you know, the community gets strip mined, you know, sold for parts. But let's talk about Jeff Bezos for a second.
Okay. I'm going to end this one quote, though. One quote. Just because if a time comes when Palestinians regain control of their land, and if the people native to the land would be open to the possibility, I would love for my ashes to be scattered in a free Palestine. Aaron Bushnell, end quote. There you go.
Wow.
And
all right.
And now I made for a terrible segue by not letting
No. It's a beautiful segue because, I mean, I think that this question of Israel, one of the things, it's decimated the liberal base of the Democratic Party. Let me give you a quick stat. And I take no joy in this because we need every resistance person we can get. You know, the approval for the Democratic Congress among Democratic voters, Chuck, was 2 years ago, 64%. It has gone right now to 9%.
I believe it.
That is a 50, if I do my math right, 50, no, it was 63-9 because it was a 54-point drop. Now, if they don't see this as a sign of crisis, if they actually don't see that the Israel question is part of it, but the other part of it is the fact that they're not fighting right now. If they don't see that, then, you know, then I don't know what to tell you, man. They're going to go the way of the Whigs.
Well, that is what's happening, because I think when we talk about the elections, we also have to talk about how Democrats have reacted as we are right now. And when you see how they are reacting right now, then I also know that these are not the people who are going to save anybody. When you hear Chuck Schumer's statements, when you hear Hakeem Jeffries' statements, and Hakeem Jeffries goes on John Oliver and says, well, you know, Aaron Judge, the baseball player, you know, sometimes he waits for the right pitch to swing to hit a home run. And I'm sitting here like, I there are too many pitches. I don't think we need to be waiting on anything. The people are out here fighting, but it is clarifying. And what is clarifying is that if we're going to get change, we have to do it in many ways ourselves. You're seeing unprecedented talk of boycotts. You're seeing unprecedented talk of strikes. You're seeing unions who are coming together and saying, let's come together and fight the dollar. You're seeing this in a way we haven't seen from places, from new places, from liberal places. So if some of the consequence of the patheticness of the Democratic Party is that people are finding that there are many tools of protest and many tools of change in that tool shed besides voting one day every 2 years and calling that civic responsibility, people are waking up to that right now.
But Chuck, we got to then talk about how we're going to get information out there.
You got it. The
Washington Post is now a dead newspaper. And I say that with a lot of tragedy in my voice because I still have friends who work there. You know, we have people on the show like the great Michael Lee. You know, Jerry Bembry is a friend of mine. Like, I don't want these folks to not have work. I want there to be journalism jobs. I want this. But at the same time, how can you work somewhere, and people are already quitting, how can you work somewhere where the guy who owns it, the oligarch who owns it, puts out a statement where he says this about the editorial team? He says, this is what he says. This is the most ridiculous thing. He says, there was a time, I got to read this whole thing.
Read the whole thing.
I'm going to let you know about a change coming to our opinion pages. We're going to be writing every day in support and defense of two pillars, personal liberties and free markets. I thought this was a parody when I first heard this joke. Yeah. I was like, yeah, right. Give me a link. Disinformation. I know things are bad, but they're not that bad. Sorry. Let me go on. We'll cover other topics too, of course, but viewpoints opposing those pillars will be left to be published by others. There was a time when a newspaper, especially one that was a local monopoly, might have seen it as a service to bring to the reader's doorstep every morning a broad-based opinion section that sought to cover all views. Today, the internet does that job. I am of America and for America and proud to be so. God, I'm trying so hard not to curse, Chuck, but you and me both. We got to remember.
FCC.
Cool. Let's just be cool. Our country did not get here by being typical. Actually, he's correct about that. The slavery and genocide was not necessarily the brutality of it was not necessarily typical, even in other places that had similar. All right, going on. And a big part of America's success has been freedom. This is so great, Chuck. In the economic realm, and everywhere else. Freedom is ethical. It minimizes coercion. I can't, how does he say this with this statement of profound coercion? Yeah. It minimizes coercion and it drives creativity, invention, and prosperity. I offered David Shipley, that was the former op-ed editor, whom I greatly admire, the opportunity to lead this new chapter. I suggested to him, that if he did, that if the answer wasn't hell yes, then it had to be no. After careful consideration, I know David Shipley, I bet it took him less than 3 seconds, David decided to step away. This is a significant shift. It won't be easy, and it will require 100% commitment. I respect his decision. We will be searching for a new opinion editor to own this new direction. Whoever takes that is a scab. Oops, that was me. I'm confident that free markets and personal liberties, except in opinions, are right for America. I also believe these viewpoints are underserved in the current market of ideas and news opinion. I'm excited for us together to fill that void. Okay, don't curse, don't curse, don't curse. All I'm going to say this. Yes, I hear people saying this in my ear. Yes, the Washington Post has always been a flawed institution. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it was like Pacifica, the newspaper. I'm not saying any of that. But people have to see this for what it is. And it's two things to me. One, obviously, it is both compliance and oligarchical complicity with the agenda of Musk and Trump. This is not about freedom. This is not about personal liberties.
Of course.
This is about tech billionaires lining up with the other fascist tech bros. But the second thing is that finally, at long last, we need to kill the idea. And this idea is so prevalent, you're not even going to believe it, that oligarchs are going to be the saviors of media that's been hemorrhaging money in the age of the internet. That oligarchs would be the people to figure it out. That oligarchs who don't have to worry about money and profits would, for their own altruistic reasons, make sure that a free press stays alive. That idea we need to see as dead as the Washington Post itself.
Well said, well said. And Jeff Bezos, as you said, does not care about personal liberties and free markets. Because it's interesting, if you cared about personal liberties, he's not talking about personal liberties of the Free Palestine protesters who've been banned from campus, who can't speak anymore because a whole host of rules will get them expelled, these rules that were over the summer. He's not speaking of those in, there's a the BDS movement and their laws, their bipartisan laws that are punishing individuals who are protesting Palestine. So if it was really about that, we know that that's even a sham. And when he's talking about free markets, he's talking about the rights of corporations. And I'm going to try to put a decent spin, which I think you kind of might started, is that what Jeff Bezos has done is tell us what the Washington Post is. And he's been honest about that and removed the level of respectability from it himself. And this is one thing that, you know, Trump does sometimes. What Trump does often is he's so outlandish and but honest about being such an oligarch that those who don't believe that, now you have no doubt. So if the New York Times, for instance, which brings with it great respect, could lead us to an Iraq war precisely because it brings great respect in some circles, or it has been a champion of genocide for the last 15 months. And not only that, but the Free Palestine protesters have been protesting in front of the Washington Post for the last 15 months, probably about 6 different times. They stop and in front of the Washington Post and says, every time the media lies, a neighborhood in Gaza dies. So the point I'm saying is, if they were previously trash, and now he's being more open about it and removing the illusion, and maybe that, if we organize correctly, that clarity could help us fight through media in other ways. That's the hope, of course. How we do that, I'm going to leave that for you, DZ.
I have no idea. But I do know that institutions like PFW are going to be critical Absolutely. The times ahead. I know that we really do need to get our heads around how we're going to communicate with one another in an age of disinformation. Like Facebook, which has been dead for so long, has recently been a hotbed because there's more room to write and people are trying to analyze things. Facebook is also owned by another broligarch, the biggest loser of them all, Mark Zuckerberg, who's going through a midlife crisis with zero friends in front of the whole world. But for Zuckerberg, like the Bezos example should make us realize that if things ever get too toasty on Facebook, we're just going to be shadow banned and shut down. Like, we have no democratic control over these institutions. And it's hardly something the Democratic Party is pushing for. I keep going back to this because, as we see, and I hate going back to this guy too, a recent Hakeem Jeffries trip to Silicon Valley, they're not trying to offend these tech bros.
They're on the same team. They really are.
Were the words that Jeffries used.
Wait, what were the words? Say it again.
Mending fences.
Yeah, you want to mend fences with Jeff Bezos. That's another way of saying I'm bought. Yes. And thank it's you for that clarity.
I'm fine with the direction of the Washington Post, too.
But let's talk about D.C. for what this means for D.C. And this is, again, why places like WPFW are so important. Absolutely, always have been. But D.C. is particularly a one media town, a Washington Post town. So they like sat out the George Floyd protests for the most part the whole time. And we were going to WPFW and at the time by any means necessary to get this coverage out. And does that leave some sort of an entryway? There needs to be that alternative media now that we have that clarity that, you know, you're not going to fight Jeff Bezos trillions, but people who are listening have to first shut down. If you get the Washington Post, if you have a subscription to the Washington Post and you hadn't canceled it already, everyone in D.C. should be canceling it because Jeff Bezos was very honest with you. So that's the first thing. It's not going to hurt his particular pocket, but then we have to be clear about getting real media out. Yeah.
And how we do it is so interesting because you know, people aren't reading like the revolutionary newspapers in their hands anymore. You know, The news comes through the phones, the news comes through the apps. But at the same time, these phones and apps also have the capacity to hold back organization and put us in this individualized mindset.
Hey, could you elaborate on that point? Could you elaborate on that point? It's interesting what you just said. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, when we only communicate with each other in bits and bursts, mm-hmm. I think oftentimes comradeship and solidarity goes by the wayside. You know, and some of the most vicious fights can be among people that you actually perhaps could reach if you were talking to them on a street corner or something.
You're right. You are absolutely right about that.
Yeah, you've experienced that.
I have experienced that. You know, people taking things online that if you were in the streets, you could have a conversation. I mean, I've in the streets. I see a lot of times there's organizing dissent and argument. And sometimes argument is not a bad thing. Conflict is a good thing. You have to work through conflict and talk through conflict. But where is that may have happened before on that street and work it through and gain some understanding. When you do it online, it becomes public and everybody jumps in, has an opinion, and poisons the well.
Yeah, and it's not even about verbiage. And I know we got to wrap up. But I was at a protest recently where people sang the national anthem as part of their protest. And, you know, as he goes, like, as in Musk is this takeover of the beauty of America. And I went to someone and I said, I'm more from the school of Colin Kaepernick, where you take a knee during the anthem. You don't sing it. And the person laughed and he said, hey, that's interesting. And we had a conversation. If I had like whatever you want to call it, tweeted, even though I don't do that anymore, at that person, I'm from the Colin Kaepernick school. You know, I don't stand for the anthem. It's read in a really different way. And
that's
people
right.
are offensive, and then they lash back at you. And then they might say something like, yeah, well, Colin's out of work. How did that work out? And then you say back, how dare you go after Colin Kaepernick like that when he sacrificed his career? And before you know it, it's not a productive discussion.
No, it is easier to have these. And I, by the way, I've had those discussions in the street, hey, how do you feel about turning that flag upside down? That's what they did in Ferguson. That upside down flags of distress. Oh. Yeah, so yes to what you said.
Yes, and great thing to end on, because the flag recently was upside down at El Capitan in, I believe, Yosemite National Park. Maybe it's Yellowstone. That's less important than the fact that people are starting to show visible dissent. And with that, I say to you all, thank you to Chuck Modiano. Thank you, Magic Mike. Everybody out there, please stay frosty. We are out of here.
The WPFW family mourns the loss of longtime host and producer Larry Applebaum, who passed away peacefully on Friday, February 21st, at age 67. WPFW listeners will fondly remember Larry's The Sound of Surprise, which had been a staple of Sunday afternoons from its inception in 1981 until May 2024. An accomplished archivist and internationally recognized jazz scholar, Larry spent his entire professional life at the Library of Congress, serving most recently as a senior music reference specialist in the music division. Larry played a key role in locating the original tapes of a 1957 Carnegie Hall concert featuring Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. After decades in storage, the recording was finally issued by Blue Note in 2005 to great acclaim. In addition, Larry traveled the world to lecture about jazz and was a frequent contributor to several jazz journals, including Jazz Times and Downbeat. Per his family's request, in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to WPFW at WPFWFM.org or by sending a check to WPFW, P.O. Box 42099, Washington, D.C. 20015. A celebration of Larry's life is in the planning stages. Stay tuned to WPFW for further details as they become available.
Hello, I am Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays at 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood. Visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Thursday, February 27th, the Howard University Department of Political Science and Howard U. Kwame Ture Society present the event Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, with veteran Black Panther Party member, Black Liberation Army leader, and former political prisoner Daruba Ben-Wahad, who will deliver an analysis on how today's resurgent right-wing agenda is an outgrowth of the ongoing and historical political struggle and what fight-back strategies should look like. That's Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, Thursday, February 27th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Howard University's Douglas Hall, room 221, at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, D.C. More information and registration for this event can be found on the webpage, daruba@howard.eventbrite.com. That's D-H-O-R-U-B-A